Hi, everyone. Welcome to Lab Medicine's podcast series. My name is Kelly Swales, and I'm the web editor for Lab Medicine. Joining us today is Dr. Eric Blank, Senior Director of Public Health Systems at the Association of Public Health Laboratories. He is going to talk to us about laboratory considerations when dealing with the Ebola virus. Hi, Dr. Blank.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Can you start us off by telling our listeners a little bit about the Ebola virus?
Sure. The Ebola virus comes from a family of viruses that are known to cause hemorrhagic fevers, and they have predominantly been identified in Africa. The Ebola virus was first identified in the mid-70s along the Ebola River in what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's an RNA virus. It is a non-envelope virus, and that's not a very hardy virus. Unfortunately, however, it's a fairly deadly virus if contracted. From what we do know about the natural characteristics of this disease, we believe that its reservoir is in fruit bats in Africa, predominantly in the rural areas. Transmission occurs by coming in contact with the virus through either ingestion of what they call bush food. This is wild animals that perhaps have been exposed by bites from the bats. Contact with infected tissues, and particularly the mucous membranes and things like that. So what we're seeing in Africa, we have had outbreaks of Ebola in the past, but they usually occurred in very rural and remote areas where it's been fairly easy to, in effect, reduce the mobility and have the healthcare teams go in and safely and securely manage patients and also take care of the deceased. What has happened in this outbreak is that it started in several different areas, that the healthcare response in the three primary countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, they don't have really very good healthcare settings, and they pretty much exhausted their resources within a very short period of time, and so we're unable to contain the outbreak. And while international help has been on the way, it has gone now where the disease has spread into some of the urban areas, which are much, much more difficult to contain the disease. So the control of the disease is fairly simple in concept. Obviously, it's to safely manage the patients that have been infected and control movement, and also to the extent possible, prevent contact by people with infected people. Keep the infected people in medical care settings, whether they're even just field hospitals and what have you, but keep them away from the general population. The other causes of this are really cultural and social. In those countries, it's very common for the families to take care of the deceased. That's a cultural issue. And that's where we see a lot of the transmission of the disease in Western Africa. That's sort of a very general picture of the disease. Through August 28th, there were 1,752 confirmed cases, a total of 3,069 cases with 1,552 deaths for a 52% case fatality rate. So it's a very serious disease. Symptoms, the incubation period is 2 to 21 days. Post-exposure with an average of about 8 to 10 days being most common. It's characterized by a fairly rapid onset of a very high fever, over 101.5 degrees, severe headache, muscle pain, weakness, moving and progressing to diarrhea, vomiting, abdominal pain, obviously loss of appetite, and then most notably, hemorrhaging. Because there is no antiviral that has commonly marketed in certainly enough quantities to do any good, care and management of the patient is mainly palliative and trying to support the patient and minimize or mitigate system failure such as kidney failure and so on. Really, that's the process of the disease and symptoms that present. It's also worth pointing out that as I read those symptoms, those of you with more of a clinical background realize these are fairly nonspecific symptoms until you get to the hemorrhaging. And in these very places of Africa, are other diseases, very commonly malaria, some of the enteric diseases, which also present with very similar types of symptoms. And, of course, in those areas, too, are the other hemorrhagic fevers. So the focus for the laboratory community and for the clinical community is, particularly in the U.S., is to really focus on ruling out those other causes of disease. And we can talk more about that later.
The current outbreak happening in Africa right now is obviously quite extensive. And understandably, people here in the United States are concerned about an outbreak here. If this virus does appear in the States, healthcare workers will be at risk for exposure. If a suspected case of Ebola presents at a facility, what sort of safety precautions should laboratory professionals and pathologists take to protect themselves?
Sure. And the first thing I'm going to do is recommend to everybody, when they have the opportunity, to go to the CDC webpage, and right at the very top they'll have the Ebola hemorrhagic fever logo that you can go to that has all the updated guidance, including guidance for healthcare workers. But the sum of it is, both for the laboratorians and for those dealing with the patients clinically, is to minimize exposure to the contaminated body fluids. It doesn't require high-level isolation, although the patients should be isolated, obviously, from the rest of the patient population in clinical settings. And certainly, the healthcare workers and the laboratorians should be appropriately gowned. And here's another thing that I would remind particularly laboratory workers. All guidance in the OSHA bloodborne pathogens rule should be followed, because that is why that rule was developed. For those of us that go back to that time, and I was there, this oftentimes has the same feeling as the early days of HIV, when people were concerned about being exposed to this brand spanking new disease that in those days was quite deadly, much of the same characteristics that we're seeing now with Ebola. But the bloodborne pathogens rule really tells us as laboratorians and the clinical community as well to say, you know, the patients are here because they have something, and we can't always assume we know what they have, so we're going to treat those specimens as though they have something that can harm us, and in this case, they really can't. But we're taking universal precautions to assure that our workers aren't exposed and those around them, whether they're in the patient community or whether they're in the healthcare provider community, are unduly exposed or inappropriately exposed. And in addition, that if there is an event in which exposure occurs, it can be reported and the appropriate management steps can be taken in order to take care of those individuals and ensure that you don't have a hospital-acquired infection. So I think those are two really, really important points to think about and to really maybe revisit. It's a good time to revisit those, because that's the guidance that you'll see, that the CDC guidance for both healthcare workers and laboratory staff really fall back on that kind of guidance with respect to handling specimens and managing suspected patients. I might say here too, the likelihood of an outbreak such as what we are seeing in West Africa occurring in most of the developed world is very limited. What we might see are patients that, the occasional patient that has had exposure over there that then comes back to the United States and then comes down with the disease. But that's not going to be the source of an outbreak. What happened in West Africa, as I said, is that in the early days of the outbreak, essentially exhausted their healthcare systems. Some of the first fatalities were the doctors and the healthcare workers that were working with those early infected patients. And it's going to take them a long time to recover from that. Our healthcare systems are much more developed. We have hospital infection control procedures and other things that can help minimize this. We have a much more robust healthcare system. The living conditions in general in the U.S. are far superior to those that we see in West Africa. For those that have been in the continent, I'm sure you'll understand that you know, it's a tough place to live in, and these are resource-poor settings, and so the conditions are ripe for an outbreak like this. They're not necessarily ripe for a disease outbreak to occur like that here in the U.S. or in the developed world. The other thing, too, to be reminded of is, as I said before, the Ebola virus is not a real sturdy virus. It's not going to last long outside of the host. And really, in the case of human fatalities, it's a dead end for the virus. Its spread is through contact with infected material to the mucosa and other elements that eating or coming in contact, swallowing contaminated material. The precautions that we have in place, particularly in healthcare workers, very, very much minimize that.
On the off chance that a potentially infected person comes back from Africa and into the States and presents at a facility, what are some of the specimen requirements necessary for Ebola testing?
Sure. Essentially, at the outset, the laboratory testing will be for things like electrolytes, probably liver profiles, that sort of thing. The routine kind of patient assessment that needs to be done for illnesses that you need to determine in broad terms where the patient is and be able to monitor those things over time. Now, for CDC's guidance and recommendations really require us to go back to the old school days, and that is not necessarily rely strictly on laboratory testing. The CDC has a case definition that requires travel to West Africa, the infected areas. It requires the fever of over 101.5 within the incubation period, the presentation of the symptoms, and it requires a history indicating some level of exposure, whether as a high-level exposure as a healthcare worker or a low-level exposure, doing some humanitarian work there and being in areas where we know the infection is prevalent and they may have been in some contact, not close contact. This is not an airborne transmissible disease, but they may have had contact with contaminated fluids outside of a healthcare setting. All of those things are part of the case definition. The second thing CDC will recommend is to rule out some of the more common and likely causes of those symptoms of those diseases. So, ruling out malaria, using a thin blood film. Don't use the thick blood film. Use the thin blood film because that requires less manipulation and it minimizes exposure to potentially contaminated material. I mentioned the routine kind of chemistries needed to monitor patient status. Once all that is ruled out and the other conditions of the case definition have been met, then if the clinician feels that they have a patient under investigation, they are to call CDC, they call their local health department first, and then also they will call CDC for a consultation to determine whether or not to take a specimen for Ebola testing. And that specimen would be a blood sample.
How should the laboratory handle these specimens?
The specimens should be handled, again, under the conditions of the bloodborne pathogens rule. No additional requirement is really necessary. And if a test is to be forwarded to CDC, then the shipping would be a diagnostic test for biohazardous level 4. It need not say Ebola on it. It doesn't have to say Ebola on it because it's a diagnostic test. And so through the consultation, guidance will be given if the decision is made to submit a sample for Ebola testing. Guidance will be given as to the appropriate forms and what information needs to be provided. But it would be that in terms of shipping, handling, and transporting, it is a level 4, the triple-packed mailing container with the biohazardous label, but it need not say on the outside Ebola, since it's a diagnostic test to determine whether or not it is Ebola. CDC will also request a second specimen because CDC will also perform tests for other hemorrhagic fevers that are in the area.
while the Ebola virus is understandably frightening, it sounds like with the proper precautions and careful handling, laboratory professionals should be safe from infection.
Yes, no doubt. And I think it's just, you know, unfortunately, it's events and situations like these that really remind us as laboratory professionals things that we might take for granted in the natural course of our work. We really need to revisit those things like the bloodborne pathogens rule and handling specimens on the assumption that they are infectious and that they do present a risk to our laboratory workers and to others. So that's a good reminder. And the second thing for keeping up to date on the latest guidance from CDC, go to the CDC website for the latest information and the latest guidance for Ebola. It applies across the board through the continuum of care. There's guidance there for clinicians and for hospitals, for hospital infection control areas, for laboratories, for the disposal of waste, all the way down to the mortuary aspects if the situation was that we actually have a fatality in the U.S. From Ebola. So it covers the continuum of healthcare, and it's a great resource to answer some of the more common questions.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with our listeners about the Ebola virus.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.